Hello and welcome to the podcast for Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is the message given by Tom Job on Sunday, September 30th, from 1 Corinthians chapter 13.
If I could speak in the tongue of men and angels and have not love, I'm just a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned, and if I don't have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It doesn't envy. It doesn't boast. It isn't arrogant. Father, help us to understand this. I think about the fact that we are in love with one who gave his life away. He gave his life away for us. And in return, all he wants is love. And so I ask you to make us serious students of love, that we would not only know what it means to love, but that we would give our heart to not only doing it, but to be willing to learn about it, to learn what love is, so that we could do it, so that we could love, so that we could be like Jesus. The world is waiting. Just like Aaron told us, the world is waiting for someone to be like Jesus to them. If it was nothing else, that we would give our hearts to this, to be like Jesus to as many people as we can. Help us to understand it. In Jesus' name, amen. Sometimes there are moments where you think you know how you should do something and you turn out like it's completely wrong what you thought. When I was in Bible school, there was a pastor who came to our school named Charles Swindoll, who turned out to be, I didn't know who he was in 1980, but he turned out to be the most awesome person ever. But he said the first time he was ever invited to a church to be their pastor, it was in Boston, and he grew up in Houston, and he had never been in New England. So the first time, it was super cold one morning, and he looked out getting ready to go to work, and all the people were out there scraping their windshields, like scraping all the frost off of it, and he thought, these Yankees are stupider than I thought. And he said, I just need to show them that it's not that hard. So he got a pot of water and he boiled it. And he went outside and he just threw it on his windshield, this boiling water. And he heard a little crinkle sound, and then he heard a little tinkle sound, and then his windshield exploded. And he looked around to make sure nobody was watching him. But you think that would be right. The other day I was reading this scientific report about whether it's possible to actually swing a golf club like Happy Gilmore, you know, where he was like a hockey player, and he thought if you run up to the ball and do a slap shot, you could hit it. Like in that movie, he hits the ball like 400 yards. And is it actually possible? And it isn't. I mean, you'd think it's a great idea, but it's not, because the difference between like a drive on a golf shot going like straight up in the air or on the ground is 1/4 of an inch of your club being too high or too low. And for every 100 yards, if your club is turned a half a degree, it'll go 20 yards this way or 20 yards that way. So you just can't do that. One time, I was thinking about physics in golf, because one time we were playing on Centennial, you know, the holes where you can see the guys playing on Edgemoor Road. I hit it over Edgemoor Road, like to the other side. And I was trying to think, like in physics, if the ball's going 60 miles an hour, if the car had been going 60 miles an hour, is that like a combined thing of 120 miles an hour, you know, when they crashed into each other? And if I had hit that ball like Happy Gilmore, I would maybe have knocked a biker off his bicycle on Haw Ridge. So you think it's a great idea, but it's not. So this is what I'm thinking about love and reading 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And I don't know if I'm saying this right, but maybe I am. But I think that love for people who follow Jesus. Love is instinctive, but it's not intuitive. And like, in other words, everybody instinctively knows that people who love Jesus should be the best at loving people. Even people who aren't Christians and don't know Jesus, they know that people who follow Jesus should love people the most because he did. And when they don't, it's confusing to them. Like when Christians are mean, or when Christians fight with each other all the time, and like different kind of Christians. I was reading the other day about this guy. And there was a girl. They were up like in the Great Lakes, and on one of the lakes there was this bridge. And he was walking across this bridge that went over a part of the lake, and there was a girl up there, and she was all obviously distressed, and she was going to jump off the bridge. And he stopped her and said, he said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I'm just so upset." And she, and he said, "Do you know Jesus?" And she said, "Yes, I'm a Christian." He said, "Oh, me too. That's awesome. Are you a Protestant or a Catholic?" "I'm a Protestant." "What? Me too. What denomination?" "I'm Baptist." "Me too. Are you Northern Baptist or Southern Baptist?" "Northern Baptist." "What? Me too. That's so awesome. Are you Northern Conservative Baptist or Northern Liberal Baptist?" "I'm a Northern Conservative Baptist." "That's amazing. Me too. Are you Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist or Northern Conservative Reformed Baptist?" She said, "I'm Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist." He said, "Me too. That's so amazing. Are you Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lake Region or Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Eastern Region?" She said, "I'm Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lake Region." He said, "This is like a miracle, our encounter. Are you Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lake Region Council of 1879 or Northern Conservative Fundamentalist Baptist Great Lakes Region Council of 1912? "Oh, why don't you just go jump in the lake then if you're 1912? And he pushed her off. But, you know, I think I was reading the other day this book about Mark Twain, who he was not a Christian at all. I mean, he was really kind of bitter about Christianity and everything. And one of the reasons was because I think just kind of growing up, he just felt that people who were Christians, there seemed to be like so much hypocrisy in it all and so much, you know, hate and stuff. And there's a place in Huckleberry Finn where Huckleberry is, you know, on the Mississippi River with Jim, who was a runaway slave, and Huckleberry was helping Jim get away, and he knew that the preachers always said, you know, slavery is in the Bible and God ordained it, and that if you help a runaway slave, it's like stealing somebody's property. But Huckleberry said, "You know, when I looked at Jim, I mean, he was so sweet. And he always calls me honey. And he heard Jim cry at night about his wife and about his kids. And how Jim would just let Huckleberry sleep and not take his watch. And Jim would do two watches. And how Jim just called me his best friend and said, 'Right now, really, you're the only friend I have.'" And Huckleberry had been thinking about turning Jim in, because apparently some preacher said it was a sin not to. And Huckleberry said, "I can't do it. I guess I'll just go to hell." You know, and I think that people who don't even know Jesus instinctively know that people who know Jesus are supposed to love people instead of hate them. But that whole thing about Christians loving, it's kind of instinctive for everybody. But when you look at what love is, it's not intuitive in the sense that the kind of love that Jesus wants us to have for people, we have to learn it. Like, you think you know what it is, but maybe we don't really. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, when Paul says, you know, loving people, nothing matters. Like, loving people It's the most important thing in the world. And if you do everything but don't do that, your life is completely meaningless. And then he says, let me tell you what love is. And he says, these are 15 ways that love does things. 7 of them are positive, and 8 of them are negative. Love does this, this, and this, and love doesn't do this, and it doesn't do this, and it doesn't do this. On the positive ones, it's maybe a little bit more obvious, I guess, that, yeah, I can understand how love does that. Like he says, love is kind. Okay, I get that. You know, and the word kind is a word that means, it's more than kind, that really means like Jesus-y. But, so I can understand love is acting like Jesus. And he says, like, love believes all things, which means, like, if you hear something bad about someone, and you don't know whether it's true or whether it's not true, may be true, may not be true, whether it's your best friend or your mother-in-law or the president of the United States or whatever, love just says, I'm not going to believe that. If I have a choice of believing it or not believing it, I'm not going to believe the worst about somebody. I'm going to try as hard as I can to believe the best about somebody. And it's like, okay, I get that. But then when he gets to the negative things, love doesn't do this. Sometimes it kind of stumps you. Like, I don't see what that has to do with loving people. And you have to kind of think about it. Like, there's the place where he says in verse 4, he says, love doesn't envy. But the some translations, it's translated, love isn't jealous. But in the actual, you know, when Paul wrote this, it was in the Greek language. And the Greek word is the word love isn't zealous. And the Greek word is the word zealous. And it means, it has the idea of boiling. And basically it means that when you think about your, you know, what you think about things and your opinion of stuff, love doesn't get all fired up and all steamed up about how right I am about things and they're so wrong. It doesn't do that. In the book of James, it says in the end of chapter 3, it says it isn't wise to do that. That's the most awesome, it's the most awesome paragraph at the end of James chapter 3 where he says, if anybody is wise, and I feel like in our country today, we need wise people maybe more than we almost ever have. But he says, if anybody's wise, let him show it with the deeds done in the humility of wisdom. But because when there is bitter, and then he uses this word, bitter zeal, when people are really fired up about how right they are, and it has kind of a bitter edge to it, when there's that kind of stuff, and when it's translated selfish ambition, but many Greek scholars say that it means like you're trying to get people on your side, and in some places it's translated having a party spirit, like our, not like the kind they had at UT, but the kind where it's like our party is right, your party is wrong, we're right, we're trying to get people on our side, and you people are all wrong, and I'm super fired up about that, and in a bitter kind of way. He says that is not a wisdom. He says it's not spiritual, it's unspiritual, and he says it doesn't come from above. In fact, he says it's kind of the earth. In fact, he says it's lower than that. He says that kind of wisdom is devilly. And he said when there is that bitter zeal and that party spirit, there is disorder and every evil thing. And I'm like, wow. You know, but he says this is what wisdom is, the wisdom from above. It's first of all pure, and then it's peaceable. Like, in other words, I want to be at peace with people. I don't want to fight with people, and I don't want to be in conflict all the time. I want to be friends with people. And the third word, he says, is it's reasonable. And the Greek word is the word that means persuaded. And it has a little prefix in it that when it comes in front of a noun, it means good, like it's the word in good news, like in the gospel. And when it comes in front of a verb, it means well or easily. And in this case, it means easily persuaded. In other words, I think something, and you might think something completely different, but I want to hear you. Like, I want to know what you think, and I want to try to understand it, because I don't think that everybody that doesn't think like me is an idiot. And I'll listen to you, and because I know there's something in what you believe that must be, true, and you can persuade me. Okay, so I could see how that's wise, but I don't exactly understand why, if a person is all fired up and they think they're right about everything that they think, and they get super steamed up about it, I don't understand why that's why love isn't that way. Except when you think about this, in order to love people, I need to recognize that there is a lot that I don't know. And if I think I know everything and I'm right about everything I think, it's not going to help me love. Like Paul says, love, he says, we know in part. Like if there was a person and they're a really difficult person to love, one thing that will help you love them is when you realize I don't know everything about them. This could be a person that suffered a lot of things, and that's why they're the way that they are. One time I was out at the Anderson County Jail, and there was a guy out there, and I mean, he was tough, and he was in there for drug selling and drug using. And it's easy to say, well, those people. But he talked about his life. The first time he ever sold crack cocaine, he was 10. And, you know, when other kids are selling Christmas wrap and flavored popcorn for their school, he was selling crack cocaine. The first time he ever used crack cocaine, he was 6. And, you know, if I'd grown up like that, I would be him. Babies can't raise themselves. You know, when... And sometimes when it comes to loving people, it says in 1 John chapter 3, it says, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called the children of God. And the word in the, I don't mean to be all Greek-y, but the word in Greek is actually a word that means from what country. It's a compound word, and it means from what country. And it's the idea that the love of God, it's not from here. It's exotic. It's like from another planet or something. So I don't always know the best way to love people. And if I'm all convinced and all steamed up about how right I am about everything, it's not going to help me love, because in order to love, I have to learn. I don't know. It's not intuitive. In John chapter 13, there's a place where Jesus, his last real time to get together with his guys, his friends, you know, his followers, before he would be arrested. It was that night, and there was a lot of things that he wanted to tell them, because it was going to be his last chance to tell them this stuff. And there, as they're walking into the room, there was a lot of tension. And the reason there was a lot of tension is because Luke tells us they had been having an argument about which of them was the greatest at being a follower of Jesus, which means they did what Christians have been doing like all the time. Whenever Jesus has something for you to do that he wants you to do, they say, let's make the Olympics out of this. And so that, you know, and that's what they were doing. And who is the greatest, and which does he like best, and who's following him the best, and let's make a race out of this. And it's like, if you race, you're going to leave him behind, because you're supposed to be following him. And, you know, but anyway, there was a lot of tension. And there's like, when they went into the room, like if you're watching a movie of this, and here, okay, so here go the guys into this room, into a dining room, and the table's all set and everything. And Jesus had a lot of things that he wanted to share, but he couldn't because of this tension. And he had to resolve it. So he gets up from the table. Okay, pause the film right here. Okay, now you have three choices. What's going to happen next? A, he walks over to James and John, and just like Mo did with Larry and Curly, bangs their heads together. Okay, B, jumps up on the table and says, I'm settling this. I'm the greatest. Or C, gets up from the table, walks to a window, looks out the window, a tear rolls down his face, and he walks out the door. And you say, I think it would probably be C. Let's roll the film. He gets up, doesn't do any of that, goes to the sink, fills up a pail with water, takes off his robe, puts on a servant's towel, starts to silently wash their feet. And you're like, wow, I did not see that coming. You know? So there's stuff to learn about love. And this is what I think, like when Paul says that love, when he says love doesn't do this and love doesn't do that, this is kind of a theory I have, and I'm not sure if it's true all the time, but it might be somewhat true in it. All of them, all the negative ones in 1 Corinthians 13, it's not that he's saying, if you do this, it's unloving. But he's saying, if you do this, you can't love. Because it takes you to a place in your mind and in your heart where love doesn't come easy if you're going to do this kind of stuff. In verse 3, he says this, love doesn't brag. And he's not, and you're kind of thinking, I don't quite understand what the connection with bragging is to love. And I'm thinking he might not be saying it's unloving. If you brag, it's unloving to do that. But what he's saying is if you brag, it makes it very difficult to love. And people brag all the time. They brag in probably sports more than they ever have. You know, like it used to be in baseball, and it's become less and less this way, that if you hit a home run, you don't just stand there and watch it. And you, like in the batter's box, like Manny Ramirez used to do, you know, where you just stand there and watch it, and then you just trot around the bases, because it's like bragging, especially to the pitcher, and it offends him. And back in the day, if you did that, like if you hit a home run and just stand there in the batter's box and watch it go, and you played against Bob Gibson, next time you're at bat, he would hit you with the pitch. Because, you know, it's just not cool to do that kind of stuff. But, you know, one guy was reading a book this week about sports and Jesus, and he said the first person who ever really did that, like really, really bragged in sports, was Muhammad Ali. But he said, but it was different because, one, when he said, I am the greatest at what he does, he was the greatest. And two, he was the first person to ever really kind of do that and talk that way. But three, he was really kind of kidding. Like he always kind of had a smile on his face about it. But then he says, but now, you know, like if a team is 0-4 and they're 24 points behind in the end, middle of the fourth quarter, and a second string linebacker crashes into a quarterback who's not even looking at him and just kind of, you know, boasts at that point, it's like, that's not cool, brother. He goes, it's just, you know, whatever, you know, but people do it all the time. One reason, like social networking, I really think is awesome. And Facebook, I really think it's awesome and everything. It may not be completely awesome. And one of the reasons I don't look at it anymore is because I do think that sometimes Facebook allows people to brag in ways that they might not even know they're doing it. But when someone says, congratulations to, you know, my daughter who just graduated honor student from so-and-so college, the smartest kid who ever lived. And it's like, that's fine. I don't know why you couldn't have just said it to her. Why did you have to say it to everybody? Because here's a family, their son dropped out of school just because he just couldn't make it. And they love him. And if you make going to college the Olympics, you win the gold medal. But why did we have to hear about it? You know, happy anniversary, honey. You're the greatest person who ever lived. And thank you for 10 glorious years of marriage. And I'm thinking, I think they've been married for 13 years, so I'm not quite sure what that means. And two, glorious, really? It's been glorious. And, you know, and here's a couple who maybe she was abused as a child. Maybe he was abused as a child. And in their marriage, it's been tough. But they're trying. And they've been brave. And their marriage hasn't been amazing. But they're making it. But then if they read that, and if the truth were told, you know, like 10 years, probably the last year may have been the fourth best of our 10 years, you know, not the eighth, but it's not the first, it's the fourth. Were they really all glorious? And you just won the Olympics, I guess, at being married. But if a person does spend a lot of energy communicating how amazing they are at life and how capable they are, it's going to make it difficult to love. And the reason is because love is difficult. And the reason love is difficult is because people are difficult. It's difficult to love a human being who is 3 weeks old and has not let you sleep for more than 2 hours at a time. And the whole time he's awake, he is screaming. It's difficult to love the love of your life when she's 9 months pregnant and none of your jokes are funny and none of your comedy routines are working. I remember one guy, he said, the reason it's easier to love dogs than it is to love kids is when it snows, it doesn't take 45 minutes to get the dog ready to go out. Dogs don't have a problem with taking naps. You don't need to buy them a cell phone. Dogs don't pester you about getting a kid. Dogs don't care if the peas touch the mashed potatoes. It costs $42 to send your dog to school. It costs $103,000 to send your... And dogs are housebroken in 12 weeks, and they don't care if you sing in public. But, you know, if you try to reach out to people who are... reach out to people who don't know Jesus, especially if they're tough. I mean, situations happen where it's difficult to love them. We used to have in our church in Italy, we were reaching out to people who were heroin addicts. And there was a guy who started coming to our church named Francesco, and he was a heroin addict. They are 97% HIV positive. In fact, he eventually accepted Jesus and died of AIDS. But Italians, when they greet each other in church, they kiss each other on the left cheek and the right cheek. And so Francesco started coming, and he always had he was always bleeding. Like he always, when he would shave, he wasn't good at it. And he always was kind of bleeding. And you're thinking, am I bleeding too? Like, do I have microscopic, like little cuts on my face? One time there was a guy, we were reaching out to these people, and a guy came to our Bible study, and he said he had accepted Jesus, and he was a heroin addict. He was in our apartment, and we had, you know, 20 people there, whatever. In the middle of the Bible study, he went in our bathroom and got out the alcohol and used it to shoot up heroin in our bathroom, came back, sat in his chair, and passed out. And I'm like, really, dude? It's that boring? That, like, you have to shoot up to get to the end of this? Some people like it. You know, it's just, people are difficult. I was reading an article this week by this woman, and she was so sweet, but she and her husband had adopted 2 children from Ethiopia, and they were older. You know, it was a blog about adoption, and these kids were like 8 and 10. And it had been a year, so she wrote an article about what the year was like. And she said, she has it in stages, like there's the pre-stage where you're waiting for your kids. And she says, the early doubts about loving a child without the helpful instincts of biology are put to rest. You don't know this kid yet, but you love him in your heart, in your bones. You can't think of anything else. You're obsessed. You dream about him like you did when you were pregnant. Then the first stage is the first 4 to 6 weeks, the honeymoon. She's here. You can't believe it. She's sitting at your table. She's sitting and eating eggs. She's in her pajamas. Your bio kids are treating her like a pet. Everyone is smiling. This is fake life. Your bios are more helpful than they've ever been, ever. And it's like you're at weird family camp. No, your new one appears compliant, easygoing, and obedient. And dear ones, this is because she's about to have the most epic freakout in the history of life. For her, this is like part of a sleepover when you get there and the games and toys are awesome, but all of a sudden it's bedtime and you're like, wait a minute. This is not my bed. You're not my mom. This is not my space. And the good feelings are gone. Stage 2 is the spaz out stage. I don't know what the straw is that breaks the camel's back. Maybe one more food that she hates. Maybe one final conversation she can't decode. A moment of discipline. Maybe the smell of something. But something will happen and your little one will lose it. The honeymoon is over, and when the dam breaks, it will flood for months. There is screaming, kicking, hysterical hysterics. There's wailing, tantrums, full-out meltdowns. You chase your beefy 8-year-old down the street and you bring him back screaming barefoot as he's running into traffic. Throw him over your shoulder, lug him home, where the two of you hunker down for the next 2 hours, drenched in sweat while you hold him tight and you whisper love into his ears, and he thrashes and he yells and finally passes out. Your sweet one is grieving. Your spouse and you are haunted, unshowered, unhinged, unmoored. You stare into each other's eyes, begging each other, begging the other one to fix this. What have we done? What are we doing? What are we going to do? Your house is a disaster. Your bios are huddled up in the corner, begging the grandparents to come rescue them. You can't talk to anyone. Everyone is beaming and saying, isn't this the best thing in life? Isn't this the happy thing, happiest thing in your life? You scour blogs and Yahoo groups, desperate for one morsel of truth, one brave person who will say, this is hard. And all you get is adorable pictures and cute stories, and you feel so alone. You feel like you've ruined your life, your kid's life, your marriage is doomed, your adopted child hates you. You want to go back to the person pining away in the pre-stage and punch her in the stomach. Stage 3, 4 months. Somewhere around the 4th or 5th month, you realize the fits are under 10 minutes and they only happen every 4th day. You're not out of the woods, but it's getting better. She's beginning to trust your love. So you start returning phone calls. You look at your bio kids and say, hey there, how have you been the last 7 months? You step on the scale and realize you've either lost or gained 10 pounds from stress. Okay, you gained them, but I'm just trying to give you hope. Stage 4, 8 to 12 months. The meltdowns are over. You wave praise banners and start speaking in tongues over this. Your new son is telling jokes in English. He's reading Diary of a Wimpy Kid by himself. He's a soccer phenom, and you start grooming him for the Olympics. No, you don't. Yes, you do. But it's just hard. And it's hard to love people because people are difficult. And if I spend a lot of my energy bragging about how awesome I am at things, it's going, usually things that don't matter, it's going to be difficult to convince myself that I am helpless in doing the one thing that matters the most, that I need help and that I need Jesus Christ to do it, that I can't love on my own, that if I'm ever going to be like him, if I'm ever going to love like him, I need him because I can't do it. And if I need to understand how helpless I am, bragging is the worst possible thing that I could do from my own heart. You know, sometimes we talk about, you know, having your time with Jesus, and, you know, it's good to do every day. But I feel like sometimes if people who love Jesus, if they don't have time with Jesus, where they say to him, you've got to help me. You've got to help me love the people in my life. I want to do it all the time, and I want to do it well. If you don't have that time, you either don't have enough people in your life or you don't care about loving them very much. Because if you do, you say to him, I can't do this, and you've got to help me. One thing that I noticed, though, in our quest to be like Jesus, in this particular thing, we're very, very different, Jesus and us. And that is, Jesus did say a lot of very bold things about himself, which I would never say anything close to it. I am the way to God, he said. If you're thirsty, come to me and drink. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. It's like that Loretta Lynn song. If you're looking at me, you're looking at country, you know? And it's just like, it seems a little bit braggy, or maybe a lot braggy. I saw a cartoon that was like back in Nazareth, you know, and there was this woman pulling her donkey, and the donkey had a bumper sticker on its rear end that said, my kid is an honor student at Nazareth Elementary. And then on another donkey, and it was Joseph pulling the donkey, and it was Mary holding the baby Jesus. And that donkey had a bumper sticker that said, "My kid created your kid," you know. But what one thing Jesus said, he said, "You're like sticks, like you're just like sticks, but I am the vine, and I'm the vine, and you're just like a stick, like a branch in the vine. You can't make furniture out of it. You can't carve it into those smoky bears that they have up in Townsend. You can't make, you know, furniture out of it. They're not good for firewood. It's not good for anything. You're just like a stick." But he said, "But if that stick is connected to me, I am the vine." The reason Jesus said bold things about himself is because he is love. And he loves people very, very much. And he wants them to know his love through us. And if that's ever going to happen, I need to understand how deeply I need him to do that. When I brag, it inhibits love because I forget how weak and helpless I am. When he says bold things about himself, it enables me to love because it reminds me how weak and helpless I am without him. You know, there's this one place I just need him. I'm weak and I need him to do the most important thing in all the world. I need him to help me, or I can't do it. To think about the most important thing in all of life, and without him, you cannot do it. And you need him desperately. There's a place in the Gospel of Luke chapter 10 where Jesus went to visit this family, and he was really close to them. Lazarus, you know, was his, you know, one of his homies, and he had two sisters, Mary and Martha. So Jesus went to visit. So they're getting the house ready, and Martha is like completely, you know, freaking out in the kitchen, just wanting everything to be super perfect. It's kind of hard to really know what she was doing because they didn't have electricity, so she wasn't running the vacuum. Dirt floor, how clean can you get it? And, you know, they hadn't invented glass yet, so she wasn't cleaning the windows. She was, you know, probably carving radishes to look like the Rose of Sharon and the, you know, folding napkins to look like the temple in Jerusalem. And some Greek manuscripts tell us that Mary and Martha, their last name was Stewart. And so, no, actually, I just made that up. But at a certain point, Jesus was in the living room, and Mary went in there, and she just sat at his feet just to be with him and all of that. And it says that Martha was disturbed that she was left alone. And the Greek word is a word that means draw your sword out. And I just have this scene of the kitchen door flying open. It's a scene out of an Alfred Hitchcock movie. And Mary has this crazy look. Martha has a crazy look on her face and a big butcher knife with tomato juice dripping down it. And they close up on her face and she said, "Make her help me." You know, and I'm like, wow. But it says, actually, it says that Mary also, in other words, she helped Martha, but at a certain point, she went to be with Jesus, to sit at his feet and just to be with him. And I'm thinking, what was it that made her decide that that was a good thing to do? And then I thought about it. This was early in the visit. And she's like, "My sister is driving me crazy. And this is going to be a long visit. And if I'm going to make it, and if I'm going to love her, I need help. I need to go to the one who can help me." I was just thinking, what if Mary hadn't done that? What if she was like, "Okay, Martha, you want to make the Olympics out of this? Let's do this thing right here." You know, and it's just like, who could be the best follower of Jesus and be the greatest of all, you know? So they just do it, and then they go out together in the living room, and Jesus not in the living room. And they're like, "Where did he go?" And all of a sudden, the kitchen door opens up, and he has a towel on, like a servant, and a pail of water. And Mary's like, "Wow, I didn't see that coming." Lord, I do just think about all of us and how all of us have people in our life that, well, we're all difficult. So I just, first of all, that you would give us a heart to be devoted, like maybe like we've never been, to be devoted to love, to loving the people in our life and people outside of our life and loving them into our life. And I do ask you, Lord God, that you would give us a sense of our own dependency and weakness like we've never felt it before. Because you can help us do this thing. We love you. Amen.
For more information about Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, including staff blogs, ministries we love and support, or just to connect with us, you can find us on the web at c3oakridge.org.